Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, our Review of the Year, Part 2. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Happy New Year, Chris!
Happy New Year.
It is now the new year.
Of course, a whole week has gone by since we recorded the last edition of Setlist.
Yes.
Because we're not recording both of these in one sitting.
No.
So how was Christmas?
Oh, it was so good.
Was your daughter still anticipating Santa's arrival?
She was, yes. It was a bit of a excitement overload.
That's your prediction.
That's my prediction, yeah.
I mean, report of what happened.
Yeah, that's definitely what happened.
Regular listeners will remember that I was going to ring some bells on Christmas morning.
Was it good bell ringing?
I rang some Grancer doubles. So that,
did you?
That's a little...
They're my favourites.
A little report. I almost certainly will. So I think that's probably going to be accurate.
You mean that is what actually happened?
That definitely happened.
Yes.
A week ago on Christmas Day, because it's now New Year's Day. What did you do for New Year, Andy Malt?
Well, you're not going to believe what I did for New Year. I hung out with the Queen.
You hung out with the Queen?
Yeah, we had New Year, as we always do.
How was she?
She was fine, you know... She got the stress of the Queen's speech out of the way, which she always frets about that. But, you know, New Year, she really lets her hair down, did a bit of dancing, a few jigs.
It sounds like it was fun.
She's now really looking forward to the royal wedding.
Which clashes with the Great Escape.
It does.
It'll be happening on day 3 of the Great Escape. So I think if you, like I, was desperately hoping that there would be a good way to escape all of the crap that will surround the royal wedding, hurrah! It happens during the Great Escape. It's going to be really easy to escape the bloody royal wedding. Although Andy Malt, who hangs out with the Queen at New Year, obviously will presumably be very disappointed about the clash.
I do not care for a royal wedding. Last time there was a royal wedding, I had my cat put down that day. And I don't know what animal I'm going to have killed this time.
Well, you've got a good 5 months almost to prepare for that. I celebrated New Year like I always celebrate New Year.
Before we go on, that really sounded like I had my cat put down just as a reaction to the royal wedding, which is what happened, actually, yeah.
Well, you did tell the cat being put down story immediately after claiming that you spent Hogmanay with the Queen, so I'm not sure anyone is taking anything that you say at the moment seriously.
Well, that bodes well for this show of facts coming up, doesn't it?
I spent my New Year's Eve sitting at home revising all the things that happened to YouTube in the last 12 months so that I would come to this edition of Setlist full of all of the information that our listeners need to be fully up to speed with all of the developments in relation to YouTube, Safe Harbour and Value Gap in 2017. That is how committed to the cause I am.
I think that's less believable than my story.
Hey, tell us what's coming up on this second part of the CMU Setlist Review of the Year 2017, even though I have just revealed half of what we're going to talk about already.
Yes, because as you say, this is part two of our Review of the Year 2017. If you haven't yet done so, go back and listen to part one, which came out on Christmas Day.
You need to do that before you listen to this edition, otherwise the plot won't make sense.
Yes, but coming up in this edition, we'll be running through our two favourite festival disasters of 2017 and our top five and finally stories of the year. But first, YouTube. Now, YouTube did not have quite the rough year that SoundCloud had, as we discussed last week. SoundCloud made friends with the music industry, and that nearly put it out of business. YouTube remains music industry enemy number one and is thriving as a result, although early in the year it did have a minor setback.
Yes, and that actually had nothing to do with its ongoing, longer-running squabble with the music industry over the royalties it pays to record companies and music publishers and artists and songwriters, none of whom YouTube really care about. They would say that they do, but I'm not sure that they do. Hey, you know who YouTube does care about? It's advertisers.
Yes, and they left in droves this spring, or certainly threatened to, when there was a controversy about adverts appearing on extremist videos on the YouTube platform. Advertisers understandably didn't like their brands being placed next to those videos, and so started pulling adverts, which was an issue for YouTube, it being an ad-funded business.
That was one of those weird things where that had been going on for a long time because of the way that the YouTube system automatically pumps adverts around videos and no human beings are involved in those placements. So it wasn't a particularly new phenomenon, but the Times, I think, ran an investigation into it And then it rumbled around the ad industry for a few weeks. And then slowly but surely, more and more brands and ad agencies were stepping forward saying, hang on a second, this is a real problem. We're going to stop spending money with YouTube until YouTube and its owner Google can reassure us that our ads are never going to appear next to this content. And actually, in the end, the CEO of YouTube did make a statement, I think, at a conference where she said, we are aware of this problem and behind the scenes, we are implementing new measures to ensure that that stops happening.
In the meantime, there was a music industry side to this story in that Vivo attempted to capitalise on it. And as Vivo's CEO, Eric Huggers, has just stepped down and talked up it being a boom year of growth for Vivo. At the time, in April, Vivo came out with its own statement saying, hey, we provide music videos to YouTube and also sell the advertising around those videos ourselves. So if you spend your money with us rather than YouTube directly, you can guarantee that your money will not be spent on extremist content.
Which in some ways was Vivo going back to its roots, because one of the reasons why Sony Music and Universal Music created Vivo back in the day was they felt that when advertising was put next to their super high quality music videos, a premium should be charged to the advertiser compared to adverts appearing next to, I don't know, a cat video. And so part of the solution to that was, okay, well, if Vivo sells the advertising around the official music videos, one of their sales pitches to the ad agencies could be, well, you're guaranteed to go next to a super high quality official music video, therefore you should pay us more. I'm not sure that argument ever really worked in Adland. I think most ad agencies were like, well, if more people are watching cat videos, we would rather have our ads next to cat videos. Although, here was an example where Vivo could say, see, we told you, this is why you should be more fussy about which videos your ads go alongside. We provide a system where we can guarantee where your adverts will go, and therefore you should come and advertise with us. So yes, although that was really an ad industry story, it did end up with a little music side to it.
But whereas that was a story that really did shake YouTube, and as you say, it prompted the CEO to come out and comment on it, the actual music business story here is the ongoing war of statements and lobbying, where the music industry continues to fight for safe harbor reform around the world so that YouTube can't continue to be an opt-out streaming service.
Yes, right at the start of the year on the CMU podcast, as it was then known, we discussed my nominations for the top five enemies number one of the music industry in 2017. And YouTube was on that list, probably topping that list. And in that podcast, we sort of provided the story so far to this. So the music industry doesn't like the royalties it receives from YouTube. As you say, that's because of safe harbor, value gap. The big development, of course, in 2016 on this front was after a few years of the music industry banging on about the fact that there is this safe harbor in copyright law that it reckons YouTube exploits in order to pay much lower royalties than a Spotify or an Apple Music, even though it competes with a Spotify and an Apple Music. In 2016, the European Commission put out a draft new copyright directive for Europe, which included a safe harbor clause in there, which is attempting to add extra obligations to user upload platforms of the YouTube variety so that they don't enjoy the safe harbor in quite the same way as, say, an internet service provider or a server hosting company. And the hope is that that article of the copyright directive will force YouTube's hand and allow the music industry to pressure YouTube into paying higher royalties. So the draft copyright directive was published in autumn 2016. The big development on that front in 2017 is nothing really, in that it has continued to go through the motions in Brussels. That copyright directive had some stupid number of amendments put forward in Parliament, in Council. That's all still going through the motions, which means it will be 2018 when that directive finally goes through, assuming that there isn't any major extra holdups as it reaches the final stages. So we should see that copyright directive go through in Europe next year, including the final version of the Safe Harbour article. We don't know what that's going to say. It will then be implemented at a national level around Europe. We assume in the UK, whatever happens with Brexit, the government has sort of indicated that it will implement this directive, whatever. But quite what that means in 2018, quite what it means in 2019 remains to be seen. The lobbyists in the music industry, well, we've always said on the podcast, haven't we, that we suspect that this new bit of European law won't be as useful as the music industry hopes.
Even if it is fairly strict, YouTube's response will probably be, well, we already adhere to these rules.
Which then means the music industry will have to sue, which means waiting for the directive to be implemented at a national level. That takes at least another year. then someone needs to sue. By that point, we would have Brexited. So even if we implement this directive into UK copyright law, it can't be tested in the European courts through a UK case. So it would have to happen somewhere else. Let's say Gamer in Germany sued. Let's say it takes 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, however many years to work its way through the German courts before being bounced up to the European Court of Justice. It could be a long way off before we get resolution on that. And you have to suspect that YouTube hopes that by that point, this whole debate will have gone away anyway. Some of the lobbies in the music industry think that if the wording that it looks like might go through does go through, then they might be able to call YouTube's bluff and get YouTube to agree to a slightly better deal rather than risk allowing that albeit long drawn out legal process to begin. So the lobbyists of the music industry still remain hopeful. But anyway, that's 2018. We're talking about 2017. So this year, not a huge amount of progress in that domain. The Safe Harbor review in the US also didn't really move forward.
Yep.
They opened a second stage. People submitted. The Copyright Office, who have done the Safe Harbor review in the US, still haven't reported on that. So basically, 2017 was just more bitching.
Yeah, I mean, YouTube's big strategy for rebuilding bridges with the music industry was to hire longtime music industry exec Leah Cohen to be its new head of music, and he was going to smooth everything out. That backfired somewhat.
Yeah, so he was hired last year, but really started working there full time this year.
Yeah.
And has mainly spent the year telling the music industry how they're wrong about YouTube and it's all great.
Yeah, which the music industry did not appreciate at all. And there were many... Well, Leah Cohen put together a blog post on the YouTube blog where he basically said like, oh, well, you know, I used to have reservations about YouTube, but now I've been here a little while. It's so good. And, oh, one day it's going to pay you so much money, so you should just stop fretting about it. And then every trade body in the music industry put out a statement saying, shut up, Leah, shut up, shut up. I'm paraphrasing slightly.
But only slightly.
Very slightly.
There were various competing figures as to what royalties YouTube pays, because Leah said, oh, in the US, sometimes you might earn this, and then all the record industry people saying, no, you don't. Of course, streaming royalties are always complicated. Throw in the fact that different advertisers pay different rates on YouTube. It's incredibly complicated. There is no such thing as a set rate. Hence all of that confusion. But yeah, very few people in either the label community or amongst the publishers or amongst artists and songwriters were supportive of what Leah was saying. That said, at the same time, everybody is still putting their content on YouTube. And that's the dilemma for the music industry. Because for all of the issues around royalties, it remains a fantastic platform for getting your music out there, reaching new fans, reaching existing fans, and there is that ad income. And although it's nowhere near enough income as far as the music industry is concerned, it is one of the few platforms that is generating actually overall quite significant advertising income around music.
But it's not just ad income. Leah Cohen was also banging on about YouTube Red, the YouTube subscription service, which is
still a thing in some countries.
It's still a thing in some countries, but it's not launched in the UK, for one, but it's the US mainly, and there are various other countries where it is live. And we finish 2017, in terms of YouTube, with the rumour that YouTube is going to launch a dedicated, paid-for, not ad-funded music streaming service, which might sound familiar, one, because we discussed it at length a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, and also, in 2015, YouTube announced that it was launching a dedicated, paid-for, not ad-funded music streaming service, which never actually launched.
Yeah, that was Music Key, which actually morphed into the aforementioned YouTube Red subscription service. So will it happen this time? We don't know. I mean, one of the other things that Leah Cohen has talked about at various points during the year is how, well, YouTube has ad-funded over here, we have subscription over here. He also talked about the Google Play streaming service, which is of the Spotify model, being more closely aligned to what YouTube does with music. And behind the scenes, that has started to happen in terms of the Google Play music people and the YouTube music people are more closely aligned behind the scenes. So it may well be that this new, well, the working title, as far as the gossipers were concerned, was YouTube Remix. Which isn't a good name. But A, that's rumour, and B, it's a working title. But the new YouTube streaming service...
It's better than Music Key, to be honest.
It's true. Assuming it ever launches, might be an amalgamation of the existing Google Play service and the YouTube service. Who knows? But perhaps this is a further attempt by YouTube, perhaps aware that there could be a new bit of European law next year, which, even if not resolute and clear what it means for YouTube could potentially put more pressure on them to pay more money to the music industry. Perhaps they can try and confuse things further by saying, well, continue to give us particularly good rates on our free service over here and we'll do a big push on our paid-for service over here. Given that in the wider streaming music market, we all know it's the paid-for services that are driving the growth rather than the ad-funded setups.
Yes, so we may or may not find out more about that when Leah Cohen appears as one of the keynote speakers at the South by Southwest conference in March.
In addition to all of the chatter about YouTube in the CMU Daily and on the Setlist podcast over the last 12 months, of course, there was also some big developments with regards YouTube-MP3.
Yes, because as well as moaning about YouTube itself, the music industry spent a lot of time this year, or certainly the record industry spent a lot of time this year, moaning about stream ripping and people using apps to take the audio from streams and save it offline in MP3 or whatever format you like. The point being, it's people saving files offline that they shouldn't be. And when we talk about stream ripping, it's usually YouTube they're ripping that audio from. And in September, not only just one of the biggest stream ripping sites, one of the biggest sites on the internet, YouTube MP3, agreed to shut down.
Yes, so in much the same way as the issue of ads on YouTube going alongside unsavoury content, stream ripping's not new.
No.
It's been a phenomenon that's been around for years. But for various reasons, it has worked its way to the top of the music industry's piracy gripe list. Not that the music industry talks about piracy at all as much as they used to, because it's usually value gap safe harbour that they're moaning about. But when they do talk about piracy, they have increasingly talked about stream ripping. That sort of kicked off in 2016 as well, but was ramped up further in 2017. YouTube MP3, which was a German-based site, faced litigation from the American record industry. And in order to settle that lawsuit, they basically agreed to switch off their servers and to go out of business. Although other stream ripping sites are available
and have become a lot bigger in the wake of that shutdown.
So I think we can expect to continue to have stream ripping as a top moan of the music industry in 2018. Indeed, when the music industry talks about piracy to lawmakers, increasingly it's stream ripping they're talking about. Although, as we mentioned on a recent edition of Setlist at the recent Slush Music conference in Helsinki, when I sat down with Andy Chatterley from Muso to have a discussion about piracy and to look at their stats as a company that works with rights owners to try and stop the illegal distribution of content online, their stats were showing that the big piracy sites in 2017, or indeed 2016, were not the stream ripping sites, although they were significant, but were the illegal streaming services that we've never heard of, but which, just like the legit digital music market, have seen huge growth in recent years.
Yes, so it'll be interesting to see if YouTube remains the music industry's enemy number one in 2018, and whether stream ripping continues to be the big piracy gripe, or in fact, as appears to be the case, the music industry realises that unlicensed streaming services are a bigger problem.
And interestingly, the solution to that is probably better ad-funded streaming. And the most successful ad-funded streaming network, arguably to date, is YouTube.
So maybe it will be piracy that makes people love YouTube again. Still to come, we've got our top five favourite and finally stories of the year. But now let's talk festivals. It's become quite common in recent years for us to report on festivals shutting down and going out of business. But usually that happens a few months in advance, or at least a few weeks in advance, sometimes days in advance. We had a couple of festivals this year that collapsed either as they were about to start or halfway through in one case.
Yes, and while it's not usually much fun talking about music festivals going out of business, particularly as it's often the more grassroots events that operate on very tight profit margins that really struggle, and nobody likes to see those go out of business, nobody likes to see all the people who work really hard on those projects go out of business, etc., etc. It has to be said that the two most spectacular failures in the music festival domain this year were, well, their collapse was more entertaining than had they gone ahead as planned. And the first is funny. And I don't know, is that because it was a rich kid festival and so somehow it's funnier that the rich kids were inconvenienced? And does that make us terrible people? The second one actually wasn't particularly funny in terms of what happened on the ground. In fact, it could have been horrible.
Yes.
The soap opera was how the management responded. So we're talking about the Fyre Festival first that happened in the Bahamas.
Or nearly happened in the Bahamas.
Nearly happened in the Bahamas. and then the Hope and Glory Festival that half happened here in the UK. So Fyre Festival first, remind us what that was about.
Well, Fyre Festival was supposed to be a really luxury festival. I mean, for one, it was on an island in the Bahamas. You had to fly out there. It was obviously going to be in the hot sun with beaches. There were going to be boat trips. There was going to be luxury accommodation. You could watch some bands. You could eat some high-quality food. It was just going to be absolutely brilliant. And it was going to take place over two weekends, like the Coachella model, where they run the same festival twice over two weekends. However, on the first weekend, people arrived to find that there wasn't much set up in the way of a festival.
At all, let alone the luxury experience that had been promised. And I suppose because it was being positioned as a luxury festival, even the basic ticket prices were pretty damn expensive. Plus, you had to get to the Bahamas in order to enjoy this, which is why it sort of felt like a rich kid event.
And their main way of promoting it seemed to have been through like hiring Instagram influencers to post images and talk it up and make it seem like it was going to be a celeb-filled festival full of beautiful people, and it'd be unlike any other festival you've ever been to, which I think it probably was.
Yeah, so not only was
not for the right reasons.
Not only was it a bunch of rich kids, it was a bunch of rich kids who are influenced by Instagrammers.
Yeah.
So in some ways that made it more amusing when it all went spectacularly wrong. Perhaps that makes me a horrible person, I don't know. Although the event itself sort of unfolded on Instagram as well, because people were flying in to this festival in the middle of the Bahamas. Some people were getting on planes in Miami waiting to fly over. And then slowly but surely, photos of this event started to drip feed out, mainly through the social networks. And as you say, it became clear they had not built a luxury festival site. In fact, they didn't seem to have built much of a festival site at all.
So aside from these pictures and videos and just tweets from the site, I think one of the first things people knew about it was a Blink 182 announced that they were pulling out at the last minute, saying that they weren't confident they could deliver a proper show for fans. Basically, I think the implication was, we've not been paid, so we're not going.
And then the photos started to drip feed out of the tents that had been built, which were supposedly these luxury accommodation places, and they were actually tents that were usually used in sort of emergency campsites. And then the luxury food, well, the only food that seemed to be available was a really rotten-looking cheese sandwich that went out over the social networks. So it clearly was not the event that had been advertised. And very quickly, the whole thing was called off. People who were on planes in Miami, the planes were grounded, and everyone had to go home. And initially, well, I suppose one thing we haven't said is that there was a celebrity behind this festival, in that it was the brainchild of Ja Rule. And this guy who became a celebrity, Billy McFarland, who apparently had met Ja Rule and they had bonded over their common love of hip-hop, beaches, and something else. I can't remember what the third thing was. Putting on really bad events. I don't know. And they bonded on that, and he'd set all this up. And initially, he was very bullish, even though the event had collapsed just as everybody was arriving. But the initial statements were, we weren't quite ready for this year, but you can get a ticket refund. Ticket refund's fine, but you might want to hold on and take a luxury ticket at the 2018 Fyre Festival instead of taking a refund. And then it became very clear that that wasn't going to happen. And the other thing about having an event mainly aimed at quite wealthy young Americans is they all have lawyers. They all have a budget to pursue litigation. And so very quickly, the lawsuit started. And actually, within the weekend, the first class action was already underway.
Well, our first report on it was the Monday after the festival was supposed to have taken place. And the headline, you know, was, it's already collapsed into this $100 million class action lawsuit. Once it got up to about 10 or 11, we had to stop having a tally of the lawsuits because we weren't sure if we'd missed any. Because there were so many, from suppliers who were supposed to be on site, from ticket holders. The government in the Bahamas was not happy about how the Bahamas was being presented as this and put out various statements saying, look, this is nothing to do with us. We didn't mess this up. This is all on the organisers. Despite the fact that, as you said, Billy McFarland's initial thing was to say, yeah, sorry, this didn't go so well this time, but we'll spend the next year making sure that the 2018 edition is really, really good. So keep hold of your tickets for next year. It'll all be fine. And then various people who'd worked on the festival started talking to the press about what an absolute disaster it had been and how everyone had been hired too late to possibly even deliver a half-decent normal festival, let alone a luxury festival. And by the summer, the company behind the festival had gone into liquidation because of these massive lawsuits pending against it. And then Billy McFarlane was arrested for fraud, which are charges he's still fighting.
Yeah, there's a lot of legal action still to go in relation to this event, even though the company behind it has collapsed. There were other fire businesses because this whole thing was meant to be launching a talent app, and that's all collapsed as well. So yeah, there are both civil proceedings and criminal proceedings that are all still going through the motions, even though, as far as I can see, there ain't no money to be had. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with all of those cases as they slowly rumble through the system in 2018. But I think the one thing that we have got out of this, because this was so high profile, it got so much media coverage, so much on the social networks, is the Fyre Festival has sort of become a term to refer to disastrous events. Yeah. So that now whenever there's a disastrous event, it is the Fyre Festival of dot, dot, dot. So just the weekend before we're recording this, there was a cheese festival in Greenwich that went horribly wrong. So it's the Fyre Festival of cheese events. So basically it has become the term you apply to events that go horribly, horribly wrong. But if there was an event in the UK, certainly as far as music festivals are concerned in 2017, that was the Fyre Festival of UK festivals this year, it almost certainly was the Hope and Glory Festival that was meant to be a new annual event in city centre Liverpool.
Yes, there were issues from the start with it. The gates opened late, bands went on late. I mean, Charlotte Church ended up not playing at all, ended up playing a small venue in Liverpool because her set was cut from the schedule at the last minute when she was already in Liverpool. And then the morning of the second day of the event, there was just a statement put out on the Hope and Glory social media, said, "No festival today," which, as statements go, is quite short. But that didn't matter because there were some really long statements to come as the fallout from this just descended into farce very, very quickly.
Yeah, as I said at the start, I suppose the entertaining part of this wasn't so much that day one was really badly organised, it ran late. There were some quite risky crowd issues on that day one. Day two was then cancelled. We're not quite sure when it was cancelled. Disagreement on quite when that announcement should have gone out. But the entertainment was less what happened on site or even what happened on that second Sunday when the event was cancelled. It was the subsequent online communications. The fact that whoever was in control of the social media on that Sunday was basically sparring with punters who were understandably angry both about what had happened on day one and the fact that day two had been cancelled with very little warning. And then the guy who ran it, Leo O'Hanlon, finally popped up on social media claiming that a junior member of staff had been in charge of Twitter the day before.
Yes, although both him and the junior member of staff had a very similar writing style on social media, but Lee maintains that it was not him.
And as you also alluded to, once Lee was officially online, then official statements started to be published that were always essay length and generally took the form of saying, "We're really sorry about this, but actually it was the fault of this production company we hired to build the site, and Liverpool City Council wasn't really our problem." And then, of course, you ended up into a couple of weeks of, will people get their money back? Will they not get their money back? Leo O'Hanlon did what I think could be described as a bit of a car crash interview on talk radio. I mean, yeah. On one level, kudos to the guy, given there was a lot of angry people out there, for going on a radio show the day after all of this had happened.
For an hour.
And Ian Lee did give him a very hard time. So on one level, kudos to the guy, but I'm not sure it helped.
No.
And slowly but surely, the company went out of business. People did get their money back, but generally at the expense of the ticketing companies rather than the company that had been set up. So I think it's fair to say that there were won't be a Hope and Glory 2018. It was a bit of a fire festival.
Yes, and Liverpool City Council's investigation into what went wrong, perhaps unsurprisingly, found that it was the organisers who were at fault and said that the council in future should really vet people a lot better.
Yes.
Before allowing them to put on big festivals in the city centre.
It's not like there's a shortage of great festivals in Liverpool, most of which are produced by local companies. So a lesson there, yeah, vet people better before you give them the centre of your city to put on a festival. So there you go, the two most entertaining festival disasters of 2017. I think most of the Hope and Glory story is probably now done and dusted, although behind the scenes a few legal wranglings continue. A lot of Fyre Festival litigation still to come. Be interested to see how that turns out. And I do think the line, the Fyre Festival of dot, 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 is here to stay.
Yes.
For some time yet.
Yes, so maybe we'll be back here in a year's time discussing the Fyre Festival of 2018. We'll see. And finally, on this second part of our review of the year, we return to our top 10 favourite and finally stories from the CMU Daily in 2017.
Yeah, so Andy has been through every edition of the CMU Daily, picked out his top 10 favourite and finally stories. We're going to very, very quickly run through them now. We did the first five last week, of course, from number 10 to number 6. So we have the top five remaining. As of last week, I'm going to name the story, and then Andy, in a few seconds, is going to remind us what the story was about. Of course, under the And Finally banner comes the Beef of the Week column. And a couple of the stories mentioned last week were actually technically Beefs of the Week, and the Beef of the Week column sort of dominates the top three for certain. But let's quickly run through some of Andy's favourite And Finally stories of the year. First of all, Tom DeLonge and his continued UFO obsession.
Yes, the former Blink-182 guitarist was named the UFO Researcher of the Year at the 2017 International UFO Congress.
And he keeps popping up in the And Finally spot.
He does. And also, since then, he's launched this new academy that encompasses various things in relation to his UFO research and how he puts it out in the form of entertainment. He's got some former CIA and Department of Defense people working there. They're raising investment. They've raised over $2 million of investment already. It's sort of, from being a joke story initially, his UFO research is actually becoming quite serious.
Yeah.
And he's very serious about it.
It probably doesn't belong in the And Finally slot anymore.
Maybe it's moving up to more serious levels in the CMU Daily.
When he makes first contact with the aliens, we'll have to give him the top story slot that day. And at least he's not a pop star going around promoting the flat earth theory. So
no.
So well done to him. Number four, Asda banning the sale of kiwi fruit to Harry Styles fans.
Yeah. So Harry Styles, he released a solo album that is not good. And everyone should stop saying that it is good because it is not. It has a song on it called Kiwi. And for some reason, fans, rather than, I mean, he's only got one solo album, so he's probably going to play almost every song off that album when you see him live. But for some reason, fans had been buying kiwi fruits and throwing them on stage as a way of requesting that he play kiwi. But a couple of times he slipped and fell on them, which obviously that's a safety issue. So he played in Manchester, and a Manchester branch of Asda banned the sale of kiwi fruit to Harry Styles fans, as you said. It didn't help because he slipped on a kiwi fruit that night. Also, there are three branches of Asda in Manchester and only one of them banned them. And I don't think it was even the closest branch. So it certainly wasn't the closest supermarket to the Manchester Arena. So I don't think it was really anything more than a publicity stunt. Yeah, it didn't save Harry Styles from potential injury.
But a publicity stunt that got Asda into the top 10 And Finally's of the year.
Ah, they tricked us.
And although I was saying that academic research to find an alien species was much better than promoting the flat earth theory, when it comes to the And Finally top 10, the latter gets you into the top three. At three, B.O.B. versus science.
Yeah, I mean, this has been going on for a long time, since I think about the beginning of 2016. B.O.B. is convinced, absolutely convinced, that the earth is flat. As an alarming number of people are, like I've seen at least three people who are convinced that this is the case. That's quite alarming in itself, because they're definitely wrong. But this year, the development in that story was that he decided he was going to launch a satellite and some weather balloons to definitively prove that the Earth is flat, ignoring the fact that satellites only work if the Earth is round, because they're satellites and they're orbit, because, well, they're satellites, aren't they? So they wouldn't work if the Earth was flat. He was crowdfunding to help him with this research. Initially, he was trying to raise $100,000. Someone then, I think, pointed out that that really is not enough to launch a satellite. So he upped it to $1 million. Still not enough money to launch a satellite. But that doesn't really matter, because at the time of recording this, he's raised just under $7,000 in his crowdfunding campaign, which is definitely not enough to look to launch anything, really.
As you say, he is not alone in believing that the Earth is flat. And of course, there was that conference for flat Earth believers that got quite a lot of coverage, because people have been writing about this and talking about it on social media. And it had one of my favourite headlines of the year. I think it was Vice's coverage, when it said, people have come from around the globe to discuss the flat Earth theory at this event.
Well, that was based on that. I think it's a social media post by the Flat Earth Society, which I'm still not sure if this was real or mocked up. But yes, it says we've got followers around the globe, which is obviously, if you're a Flat Earth Society, you're not supposed to believe in a globe.
Number two in our top 10 And Finally's, Russia versus Ukraine, which sounds like quite a serious story.
It is a serious story.
In all my family, but this is Eurovision related.
Yes, diplomatic relations or lack of between Russia and Ukraine spilled over into Eurovision. They already had done because Ukraine won the 2016 edition of Eurovision with a song that Russia argued breached Eurovision's no politics rules. Then Russia had initially indicated that they weren't going to put anyone forward to perform at the Ukraine Eurovision Song Contest this year in protest against that. At the last minute, they did put someone forward. However, that person had performed in Crimea, which is now a disputed territory between Ukraine and Russia over who owns it. And as a result, Ukraine has a blacklist of anyone who's performed in Crimea is not allowed to come and perform in Ukraine. The Russian Eurovision entrant was one of those artists. And Ukraine said, basically, if she comes here, we will arrest her. And so there was a whole thing where they worked out a system where Russia was going to be allowed to broadcast its performance from Russia via satellite so that she didn't have to go to Ukraine and perform. Then Russia said, oh, actually, no, we're not going to bother. We're not going to take part this year. And it was all a big kind of diplomatic incident over Eurovision, which is supposed to be about bringing people together and fun. And it was funny. So
it achieved its...
It did achieve its goal.
Its remit.
But not through the usual means.
And finally, the number one and finally story of the year. Many and finally stories. Bob Dylan versus literature.
Which I think, actually, Bob Dylan's Nobel Prize was our number one and finally story of 2016. But who would have thought it would still be continuing on? Because there was the whole issue, obviously, as we discussed before, Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize in Literature. People thought that was a bit weird, including him. So there was a whole thing about whether, you know, will he accept this award, will he not? In the end, he decided he would accept it.
But that was after not saying anything for quite some time.
But then there was a whole issue of he has to give a lecture within a certain period of time in order to claim the prize money. It looked like he might not bother doing that. At the last minute, he did provide a written and recorded speech, which was enough for him to go and get the money. He went and collected the prize sort of in secret rather than going and doing a big public event like people normally do. And then, this is what our top and finally of the year is, it turned out that he'd plagiarised bits of his Nobel Prize for Literature winning speech from a study guide on Moby Dick, which was, it was all a bit weird.
Yeah, so he referenced Moby Dick in his speech that he didn't really properly deliver.
But he then quoted from... Well, he then apparently quoted from Moby Dick until someone said, that quote isn't in Moby Dick. And they found it in this study guide. And then a couple of people did bits of research and they noticed that there were actually things that he'd lifted from elsewhere and put in his speech, which is sort of, well, that's funny, isn't it? And also, Bob Dylan throughout his career has lifted bits and pieces from elsewhere. He's sort of known as a magpie of taking other people's work and working it into his own. So it sort of fits in with what he was given the prize for.
So funny, but also a work of literary genius. Bob has never really commented on those observations. All he's done is put out a paid-for version of the speech, which you can now buy if you so wish. And why not, I say?
Yes, indeed. Maybe you got it for Christmas this year. See if you can go through and pick out which bits are or are not written originally by Bob. That's all we've got time for on our second edition of our review of the year. We'll be back next week with an episode of the show looking back on all the things that happened over the festive break while you were enjoying our pre-recorded review of the year shows. In the meantime, you can get in touch with us on social media. We're SetlistPod on whichever social media we're on these days. Or you can email us on setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk.
Happy New Year once again.
Happy New Year once again. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.